Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Sarah Tyson, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Michael Devitt, distinguished professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, emeritus. His new book, Biological Essentialism, is just out from Cambridge University Press. What makes a species? What keeps all the members together? Aristotle answered the species question by positing unchanging essences, properties that all and only members of a species shared. Individuals belong to a species by possessing this essence. Biologists and philosophers of biology today are either not essentialists at all, or if they think they are essences, they are relational historical properties. In his provocative book, Devitt argues for a new form of biological essentialism in which intrinsic essences, probably largely genetic properties, are part of what ties species together, and that the actual explanatory practices of biologists commit them to this view. Devitt responds to many philosophers that have been critical of this position, and he also applies his essentialism to ongoing debates about race realism and anti-realism. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Michael Devitt. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hello, Gary.
Nice to talk with you after such a long time.
Yes, indeed.
Before we get started, I always like to start with a little bit of introduction in terms of, you know, who you are, what your interests are in philosophy, and then how you came to write this book. I mean, most people will know who you are, but it's always interesting to know how you came to write the book.
Right. Well, it's actually quite a nice story, too. As you know, I really worked, the center of my work has always been in the theory of language, and I was working on an issue in the theory of language, rigidity, which my friend Saul Kripke introduced into the philosophical jargon, and I was writing a paper on the problem of applying rigidity, which was introduced primarily for singular terms, applying it to general terms and kind terms in particular. And in the course of writing this article, I had a thesis that the notion of rigidity we needed was one not of rigid designation, but rigid application. That's what we need when we get to kind terms. And what I discovered I realized as I wrote this was that this committed me to certain essentialist views. And if we applied rigid application to biological kinds like tigers, it had consequences, essentialist consequences for tigers. It seemed to require that if something was a tiger, it was essentially tigers, and it required that tigers, in fact, have essences. And not only that, it seemed to me intrinsic essences. So I knew enough about biology because I have hobnobbed with a lot of philosophers of biology to realize that that was a controversial view. And so that I researched it, and I read a wonderful article by Samir Okasha in which he set out the consensus view about essentialism in biology, both essentialism of kinds like tigers, but also essentialism about a particular tiger, say Benji. And I was quite stunned by what I read in Samir's paper, because it seemed all wrong to me. I thought that this consensus view in the philosophy of biology, and to a degree in biology, though of course most biologists are not worrying too much about these metaphysical issues, seemed all wrong. So I immediately sat down and I put together what I called heretical thoughts on biological essentialism. And I sent this around to all the philosophers of biology I knew, which were quite a few, because several of my students are philosophers of biology, and it's also quite strong in Australia. And also I sent it to a lot of people I didn't, but philosophers of biology I didn't know. And it was about 8 pages. Anyway, I got this absolutely, you might think, you send something like this out, nothing very much will happen, particularly since I was disagreeing so much with the consensus. And quite the contrary, I got wonderful responses from people, just terrific. I ended up with 100 pages of email exchanges on this. And what was interesting about the first, that in itself, this wonderful response, I mean, all full of help too, guidance, saying, because I hadn't read anything except Samir Okasha's paper. And they pointed me to this and they pointed me to that. And basically they said I was wrong, but they were extremely polite. And in this, I have to say, a terrific contrast with, and I had disagreements with the Chomskyans, who don't take disagreement well, I think we can say. Anyway, but the thing that struck me was this: despite all this help and this disagreement, my fundamental argument stood up. And I guess we'll get to my fundamental argument later on. So I thought, that was how I got going on it. And I wrote my first paper on it. I started writing pretty well straight away after this. I just published the paper on rigidity, and I went on to publish my first paper on this, which is called Resurrecting Biological Essentialism. That's a response to, was it Elliot Sober? Someone said that biological essentialism is dead. So I resurrected it. And that was my paper. And that's how I got going on it. It stirred up quite a controversy. And one thing led to another. I wrote several more papers over the years. And then I put them all together in a book. Oh, and there's one further thing. Later on, as I was writing this book, I got a little bit engaged, partly because of someone who came and gave a talk at CUNY, Kayshawn Spencer. I got a bit engaged in thinking about racial realism and racial essentialism. And so I thought, well, I'll add that at the end of the book, sort of sex the book up a bit with a whole chapter on race, realism, and essentialism. So that's how it came about.
Okay, good. Well, I hope we will get to the main themes and the racial part at the end. But okay, so to get started on your position, right? You call it in the book partly intrinsic biological taxon essentialism. In other words, you're not saying that, you know, that all of, you know, the entire explanation of a biological taxon is intrinsic, but that it is a partly but essentially intrinsic. So could you first explain your basic view?
Yeah, okay. But first, let me just remark on that, the context. Yes, the received view, which I rejected, was certainly that there is no place for intrinsic essentialism in biology. The consensus the main consensus in the philosophy of biology, and to a degree biology, is that the essence of a kind is a relational matter, in particular, a historical matter. Okasha puts it, the essence of a species is being a certain chunk of the tree of life. Exactly what that amounted to was one of the puzzles for me, and it's one of the things we might get to later, because I addressed it. But that was the consensus of the people who are prepared to talk about essences. But essences is the word essence is a bit of a dirty word in biology, and so a lot of people don't talk about it, and some actually explicitly reject any sort of essentialism. Excellent philosopher of biology, very interesting philosopher of biology, John Dupré, for example, does. So there's a sort of mini position among the philosophers of biology, but perhaps sort of a different consensus that there are no essences, right? So that's the background. Now, what I was urging, I didn't want to resist the idea that there was a historical component to the essence. I thought, I don't know if this is true, but it seems quite likely. And so I was explicitly not rejecting that. What I wanted to say was that, and so I wasn't rejecting that part of the consensus, but I was wanting to reject their denial of intrinsic. So I wanted to argue for an intrinsic component to the essence. And my final end up position in the book is that there is both an intrinsic and a historical aspect of the essence. So what is an essence? If we take some kind or some property, doesn't matter whether we took property, it's the essence of P is given in this way. There are various ways you can put it, but here's one way of putting it. Something is a member of P, or in virtue of something. And whatever it is a member of the P in virtue of is the essence. What you could put it another way, what makes something a P? Or another way to put it is, what is it to be a P? And instead of talking of essence, you could talk of nature. What is the nature of being P? What is it to be P? What makes something P? Again, as I said, or you could talk about the identity. What is the identity of P? Or even, I avoid this, but some people like this talk, the definition. So people will talk, for example, of the definition of water. And they're not talking anything to do with semantics. They're talking of a scientific definition. The scientific definition of water is, we all know H2O. This is a statement of the essence. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about essences. And then what's this historical versus intrinsic? Okay, it's very easy to get a grip on this. Some essences are fully intrinsic. An obvious example would be gold, the essence of gold, and it's having atomic number 79. Some essences are partly intrinsic and partly relational. My favorite example is, think of a pencil. Now, the intrinsic essence, the essence of a pencil is partly relational. It's something to do with its relationship to us. For something to be a pencil is for it to function in a certain way, and that it has that function is something that depends on its relationship to us. And it doesn't have to be just a relationship to us. You've got some kinds, nests, for example. A nest is a part, the essence of a nest is again partly relational. It's relational, of course, to the organism for which it's a nest. So the essence of a pencil is partly relational, but it's not fully relational, because its essence really is being a writing instrument. Partly that, but so too is the essence of a pen. And yet pens are different from pencils. What's the difference between a pen and a pencil? Well, let's not go into this, but it's obvious it's something intrinsic, right? It's something about the way it works as a writing instrument. So if you want the essence of pens and pencils, you've got to talk partly of some relational aspect to an organism and partly about what's intrinsic to it. So you can have fully intrinsic essences like gold, partly intrinsic, partly relational like pencil, and then you can have fully relational. Being Australian is my favorite example of this. Something is Australian in virtue of its relationship to Australia. And almost anything, probably indeed anything, can be Australian. So, you know, the Sydney Opera House is Australia. Rupert Murdoch is Australian. The saying, no worries, mate, is Australian. All of these, the Penfolds Grange is Australian. Great bottle of wine. So all of these things are Australian. The only thing that makes them Australian is their relationship to Australia. It's nothing intrinsic. So you can have essences of all sorts. And I believe that all kinds have essences, even uninteresting kinds.
So let me just, okay. So maybe we should talk a bit about the, you know, the fact that it's a dirty word in biology. I mean, you do touch on this, the idea that, you know, the term self of essence, you know, has this Aristotelian, you know, trappings, as you put it, of, you know, some sort of, you know, unchanging, you know, fixed, you know, essence that, you know, ties all these things, whatever, you know, in this case, species together. And, you know, I mean, there's that. Presumably that is not what you mean by essence, because that's what, you know, I don't, you want to, or in the book anyway, you modify the notion of essence to avoid these Aristotelian, you know, implications of it, right? In the light of, you know, the fact that there's like constant variation and, you know, all that kind of, you know, there's, you know, nothing in biology is 100%, you know, there's always exceptions everywhere. So how do you explain what an essence is given all the variation and indeterminacy and all those sorts of things? Why call these properties essences at all if once you take away the Aristotelian trappings?
Well, okay, let's have a word about Aristotle and the trappings. I don't know. I am no historian of philosophy, and I'm not qualified to comment on what Aristotle's views were on this. And by the way, neither nor are nearly everyone who does comment on them. So I just don't get into that at all. But when people, philosophers of biology who are on the other side on the essentialism issue here, talk of things as Aristotelian, and which they're against, well, if I'm against them, I say I'm against them too. I'm not taking on the issue of whether my view is Aristotelian or not. But let me just say that there are people who have similarly intrinsic views about the biological essences to me, who say that these views are the sort of views I urge, which I'm defending, are quite Aristotelian. I don't know, Carrie. I'm not interested in trying to argue. Aristotle was an incredibly great philosopher, but we don't have to now be worrying whether or not our views are Aristotelian or they're not Aristotelian. What matters is whether they're true. And so I don't get into that. I'm not interested in arguing that historical issue. Why call it, I may not remember everything you asked, but why call it essentialism? Look, I'm not wedded to the word essence and essentialism, but I'm not scared of it them either. And I use the word because that's the familiar word. It's what the philosophers of biology and some biologists are talking about. They talk about essences. So it would be perverse of me, it seems, to not go along with this usage. And particularly if I didn't go along with the usage in order to minimize my real opposition to what they're saying. My disagreement is just best stated by using the very language that they use.
Okay, fair enough. So what's
but
your...
as I said a little earlier, let me just interrupt, sorry. So far as I'm concerned, we could talk, and in a way I feel more happy talking of the nature of things.
Okay. So the nature of, you know, a species or being a member of a species is partly intrinsic, right? It's a matter of some intrinsic property or not.
Yes.
Okay. And so what sorts of, well, two questions then. One is, and these are related, I think, you know, what sort of intrinsic property or properties do you have in mind? And second of all, what's your argument for thinking that these intrinsic properties are in fact part of what makes a species what it is?
Right. Okay. Well, the obvious place to go, where everyone goes when they are thinking of the intrinsic properties or wondering about the intrinsic essence, they go to the genes. But it's important, it seems to me, to be a little bit non-committal here in the thesis. So I am it's not too clear. I mean, the science is not as clear to me, and I think to anyone, as it should be, just exactly what there is. Some underlying, intrinsic underlying property, which is the essence. I tend to say something like largely genetic or probably largely genetic, but I'm pretty non-committal. It's, you know, as I said, this is where one automatically starts thinking of the genome. So, you know, we hear the popular press are fond of this, talking of the genome of the Neanderthal and the genome of the human. Right. Well, that's surely zoning in on the sort of underlying intrinsic property that I'm talking about. But I want to leave it to science. I mean, this is the only respectable thing for philosophers to be doing. The nature of biological species is something that we're still learning about, in my view. But I want to say it's a partly intrinsic, underlying, largely genetic property.
But if biologists, you know, as a group, don't individuate species by intrinsic properties, that's probably because they have discovered a lot about genomes and genetics and developmental trajectories, and they say, whoops, nope, there is no such thing.
Well, I see. I just think that's false, you see. I think they do. We've got to distinguish here, as always, you know, between what people say, what their theses are, and what they actually do. And I think the practices of biology, the actual practices of biologists, whatever they say when you get them aside and start addressing them in a philosophical manner, their actual practices are committed to implicitly committed to historical, partly historical and partly intrinsic essences. That is my view. And what I'm saying here about biology, of course, is not something special about biology. It's the same. I mean, when I was growing up in philosophy, we were seeing the death throes of positivism about science. And there was a realist movement in science, which I became part of, arguing that for scientific realism. Now, one of the things we people pointed out was that scientists in their practices were realists. Actually, see what physicists do, and it's implicitly realist. That is, it's implicitly assuming the very existence of these unobservable entities, which his theory talks about. But draw them aside and say, no, so, okay, so what's your theory of unobservables? You were a scientific realist. And they'll tell you no, because they were brought up, they did a bit of philosophy when they were undergraduates, and they were taught instrumentalism in philosophy 101 or something or other. And that's what they think of as philosophy. And so they would trot out an instrumentalist view. Oh, no, I don't really. Oh, no, there aren't really electrons and atoms. Viruses, you might ask. there aren't really. This is just a way we speak in order to, and so on and so forth. But that isn't actually what was going on. And similarly in biology, it seems to me, whatever they say, and I would say the same, by the way, about linguists, when they are denying the Chomskyan linguists, when they're denying this, that, and the other. But look at what actually goes on in linguistics. It seems at odds to me with what they're saying. So it's common for scientists to practice, to do something in their practice which exemplifies a commitment to a certain position. Yet when asked about that position, they will deny it.
Well, so what are these practices? I mean, you mentioned, you know, certain certainly specifically certain explanatory practices, but can
you go into
the practices you're talking about here?
Yes, right. So yeah, I think you're right. It's time to get to the main argument. And the main argument is really simple. Now, this was the argument that it's an explanatory argument, and this is what I set out in my heretical thoughts, which you remember how the whole thing got going. As long as I can remember in my life, I've had what I suppose is, I'm told, is an Aristotelian view about this, that, you know, things have natures, and these natures, and this is the key thing, these natures explain the way the thing is. Since I got involved in this business, I've discovered that this is indeed a very old idea. Going back, again, scholars, I'm not one, say it's to be found in Aristotle. So the key thing about an essence or a nature is that it's in virtue of having that nature, that nature explains, along with the environment, all the characteristics of the object. So you see a lump of gold and you see gold, and it has all these characteristics. It's yellow, it's malleable, it's very dense, it has a certain boiling point, it has, and so on. All of those properties, everything you observe about it, is to be explained by its nature, its essence, if you like, together, of course, with the environment. Let's never forget the environment. Change the environment, and gold is different, looks different, behaves differently. Make it cold enough and it won't be malleable, and so on and so forth. So that's the key idea about essence. And what triggered my heretical thoughts was the essence of these species, and everyone talks of species, but all the taxa we need to talk of, genera, families, orders, and so on and so forth. The properties of, here's one of my examples, the property of Indian elephants and Indian rhinos and African rhinos can't be explained except by something that is partly intrinsic. Indian rhinos have one horn, African rhinos have two horns. There's always a bit of a problem because of the freaks and monsters, but leave that aside. Any rhino in India, an Indian rhino, will grow up to have one horn. Any rhino in Africa will grow up to have two horns. Why? What explains just that one thing? And it's something to do with the nature of these animals. And the difference between the natures is what counts for the one horn and the two horn. That is the basic idea. It's a causal explanatory question. The nature has to explain the way things are. And you don't, and this is the argument that runs right through my book.
Yeah, okay.
It's actually, as I said, a very old point of view. And I can't remember a moment in my life where I didn't believe this. Long before I, in fact, you know, even at kindergarten. But anyway, it's an old idea. In my book, I don't attribute it to people. I pick a very eminent an extremely good philosopher of biology, Eliot Sober. He articulates this idea at one point, even though he's basically an anti-essentialist, but he nonetheless expresses this view of what an essence must do. It must do play this explanatory or causal role.
Right.
So I call this, all through the book, the Sober Demand.
Okay.
He was he was quite tickled that he got last name. Yeah.
Okay. So here's, I mean, maybe this is what Samir Akasha was getting out with his, definition. You mentioned very brief, in one footnote and just kind of by reference to Hox genes, homeobox.
I'm sorry, I'm not following you.
The homeobox gene, right? You call them Hox.
Oh.
Yeah, you don't
Oh,
really
yes, right.
you don't go into them. Okay, so but here's the essential point. A lot of these, the internal, you might call it the internal properties or features, of the genome or of epigenetics or of development,
Yes.
these do explain, why a particular species has a particular observable characteristic, but
Right.
the properties themselves are individuated across a number of species. They're not intrinsic to each species. And the reason why I mentioned the homeobox is because the rhino, both rhinos, the very look of the body plan of a rhino, but the body plan of any eukaryote depends on the homeobox gene, which is individuated across all of them. And so you can say, oh, the reason why the rhino has such and such observable characteristic is because of its genome. But the part of the there but there's different parts of the genome, and many of those parts are not specific to the rhino, but instead are shared across many species. So you have lots of intrinsic genomic stuff that's explaining the external characteristics, but these things are not specific. They're not cut species by species by species.
Right. I'm not sure I'm getting your point entirely, but because it sounds to me as if it's quite straightforward in agreement with what I'm claiming. I'm not talking about species. I'm talking about the essence of, I'm not talking of species in particular. I'm talking of the essence of taxa. And I mean any taxa that are thought to be in the Linnaean hierarchy. Now, of course, the hierarchy goes up and up and up, as it were. And of course, there are lots of properties that are explained. There are lots of properties of any organism that are explained quite adequately, not by its being of this particular species, or even this particular genus, or even this particular family, and so on. Because some of them, for example, if it's a mammal, very high up. That alone explains a whole lot of its properties. That it's because it has the essence of a mammal, not because it's a Canis familiaris. It's because the primarily explanatory thing here is it's because it's a mammal that it has a lot of these properties. Take a particular fox. Let's call him Fred. It's actually a red fox, the member of the species Rufus rufus. Now, a lot of its properties are explained primarily by it being a member of Rufus rufus, the particular bushy tail with a white top. Many other properties of it are explained by it being a rufus, which is the genus, namely the retractable claws. Other properties are explained by it being a canidae, which is its order, that it walks on its toes. Dogs, jackals, foxes all walk on their toes. So, what does the explanatory work for a particular organism may often be something, a taxon, being in a taxon that is actually quite far above being a species. So, that's what I feel, that's what, how I respond to the points you're making, which I totally agree with. Yeah.
Okay, so there's always some, which I guess what you're saying, there's always some residue there that is not going to be individuated across various species.
Right. But not any species. So you know, let me just stop for a second. It's very hard to talk in, as I've discovered, in the philosophy of biology, it's, or even talking to biologists, it's very hard to get them to talk about anything but species. But species, and in fact, and blood runs in the gutters in biology over what it is to be a species, the famous problem of the species concept. I think this is a little bit of a distraction from if you're really getting into the metaphysics of things here. Just the same things happen within a species, the sort of variation you're talking about. I mean, species have subspecies. One of the examples I deal with in the book is the garter snake, the California garter snake. Now, there's ones that exist on the peninsula and there's ones that are at the coast, and they're different subspecies, but they're subspecies of the one species. And the two subspecies differ quite strikingly. That's why they were picked out as subspecies. So if you want to explain the properties of a garter snake, there are lots of things you can explain which cover both the peninsula and the coastal. And there are lots of things you can't. You have to go to the subspecies in order to explain the particular skin color, right? So there's a hierarchy of explanation, which sort of, in my view, of course, appropriately matches the hierarchy of the taxa.
Okay. So one of the things that occurred to me when I was reading, when I was thinking about your, you know, explanatory argument, you know, the idea that biologists are somehow implicitly committed to intrinsic essences, because they will say things like, you know, if it has such and such features, it's because it's a mammal, right? To use the example that you gave earlier, or it, because it's a rhino of this particular species or something. And, you know, I was just wondering, those sorts of explanations, you know, struck me not so much as what, say, a biologist would give to their colleagues, you know, in biology, but rather, you know, the sort of explanation, something that would count as an explanation in a pedagogical context or folk biology context or popular science, where they're sort of placeholders. You know, you talk to a, you know, somebody who doesn't know much about biology and say, you know, why does this particular animal have this feature? You know, it's because it belongs to this species. And that's perfectly fine, it seems, as a, you might call, folk explanation. And it could be that commitment to intrinsic essences is part of what explains why people believe those sorts of, or affirm or offer those sorts of explanations. But it wasn't clear to me that this is actually the sorts of explanations that a biologist will be giving to each other. So is this a view of...
I haven't done the sociology, Carrie, but yeah. What matters here is what is the explanation?
Well...
Right? Look at the biology. What is the informed explanation? Given the biological facts, what is the informed explanation of the Indian rhino having one horn? What is the informed explanation of the zebra, or do you call it zebra? I've got cultural jumble from these many English-speaking worlds I live in. Has stripes. What is it? What is the, you know, that's the key issue. What are the facts?
Yeah, but thing is, lots of different animals have stripes, and there's a common sort of developmental reason why their patterning takes on a particular, you know, it, you know, why there's a particular pattern. And that explanation will be the same across numerous species. So the explanation will not be, you know, just that species. It'll be one that equally applies to other species that have striped. So in what sense would, the explanation require an intrinsic property.
I'm not sure what's going on here. We've got to distinguish two things. One is the what I follow. This is Meyer's distinction, which I put a lot of emphasis on, between structural, between, he called them proximal and ultimate explanations. I think that's very unhelpful. The terminology, Fitcher's seems to me much better. He calls the two sorts of explanations structural or historical. And when you say why do zebras have stripes, you could be asking either of those questions. When I'm arguing for the intrinsic essences, I'm asking the structural. I'm looking at for a structural explanation. That is, what is it that when this organism is born into the world that is in fact a zebra, what is it then about this organism that causes it in its environment to end up with stripes? And there's an answer for that, which is has no reference to other species or anything else like that. I mean, it may have explanations in common, but then you've got the historical question, which is a different one. How did it come about that there were all these organisms with stripes? That's a historical evolutionary question. And of course, there's certain sorts of evolutionary pressures which have led to that, just as they've led to other sorts of organisms. So, we have to just take each explanation as it comes. But the stripes one is really good. Sarah Jane Leslie, in a terrific article, which is very critical of essentialism, and so I think she's mostly wrong, but it's a terrific article, and I spend quite a lot of time responding to it. She has a lovely example to do with stripes. In fact, there's a lily that's striped, and of course there's tigers and there's zebras. Yes, so you can have different explanations of stripes in animals, and I think you can have the same one. The story just falls where it may, but it's always going to be an explanation that appeals to a certain nature.
Well, it does appeal to an intrinsic, property. If you need, but the question is, going from intrinsic property to intrinsic nature seems to be the key bit here.
Yes, it is a key bit. You're absolutely right. And in my arguments with the biologists, this has really been so that I keep being told, in my original resurrecting paper, I said the historical explanations as historical essence cannot do the job required of a structural explanation. And in my critics, some of the critics like Arashevsky have said, yes, they can, and so on. And so we've been back and forth. But this is a key issue. You're right. I say that relational or historical explanations are explanatorily hopeless when it comes to structural properties. You want to explain why... I'm just going to be repeating myself. You want to explain... I mean, how can a historical explanation explain Indian rhinos having one horn and African rhinos having two? The structural explanation, how could they help with that? I don't see any, it's just, they're explanatory hopeless. That's the line.
Okay.
But you're right. This is where a lot of the action is. It's all an action on what is doing the causal work.
Yeah. Okay. Let me see. I want to make sure we have enough time. So let me ask about individual essences, right? AKA Heyxades, but you don't use that word because that's Aristotelian. What's your view?
Well, I don't think of it as Aristotelian. I think of it as old time metaphysics. And okay. I'm Aquinian. I don't get involved in that sort of dark areas. No.
Okay. So do individuals have essences?
Yes.
Okay.
All individuals have essences. Yes.
Okay. So can you explain
that? Not just biological individuals. I think all kinds have essences and not just biological kinds. And I think all individuals have essences and not just biological individuals. And the only thing then is to figure out what the essence is.
And you also make the separate argument that that individuals are essentially members of the taxon or taxons to which they belong.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a separate issue.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's actually interesting, Carrie, because, and which, as if you, since you've read my book, you'll notice I'm rather sensitive to this. This is not an issue. This whole matter, these issues to do with individuals that you've just raised, is not a matter that has received until recently any attention at all in biology that one can discover. There has certainly been a lot, of course, about the essence of taxa, but not particularly species, but not about individuals. And it all got going in a very striking article by Joseph Laporte called Essential Membership. And he addressed the last of those issues you mentioned, that is it the case that an organism that is a member of a species is essentially a member of that species? And he argued no, and he implied, I think rightly, that this was the sort of answer that was implicit in a lot of what's going on in biology. But no one had really addressed this issue until him. Okasha came along in the article I've already mentioned that I got going with, and he endorsed what Laporte had said about essential membership. So, and that was, that article of Okasha's was 2002 and Laporte's was 1997. Until then, no one had raised these issues at all. But what's striking about to this day is no one has raised, even addressed in the philosophy, but until I did, the issue of what is the essence of an individual. That is, what Laporte and then Okasha did was deny something about the essence of an individual. They denied that it was essentially a member of its species, but they didn't say anything about what its essence was. And that's what I addressed. So I'm, as far as I know, the first person to actually address this issue. And this makes you worried. If you're not into old time metaphysics, which I'm not, you should think to yourself, if biologists or philosophers of biology have not actually addressed this issue, maybe it's not of serious scientific interest. And I do try to show that it is. But it's really a striking thing that it has not been addressed. And so I've forgotten which philosopher of biology remarked that, maybe it was Okasha, that whereas the essences of kinds, like taxa and so on, was something that we look to biology for answers, when it comes to individuals, we just sit in our armchair and do intuitions. And I, of course, take a very dim view of that in general. And so, of course, I had to resist that. So I think the argument for individual essences is analogous to the argument for kind essences. And here it is in a nutshell again. Every individual has certain properties, which we can all observe, and some that we can't observe. And it has all those properties in virtue of its nature or its essence. And so its nature is what explains in the environment, of course, the way it is. Again, it's this is a very old idea. That's how I approach individual essences. And I propose my theory is, I describe as Kripkean. Kripke, of course, did it all from his intuitions, which were astonishing. See, one of the things you could say about what I'm arguing in my book altogether is Kripke from his armchair got a lot more right than the philosophers of biology studying biology. And they are very dismissive of Kripke and Putnam, and saying things like, someone remarked on Kripke and Putnam that they were somewhere to the right of Aristotle. That was Ruse. Ruse is a very nice remark. So I think Kripke, by the way, is expressing also, it seems to me, views which are pretty well innate in ordinary humans. People grow up really with essentialist views, as psychologists have demonstrated. So I think the little children and Kripke and Putnam are basically right, and the philosophers of biology are wrong.
Well, and that kind of goes back to the issue I raised earlier about whether this is really about folk biology rather than actual biology.
Didn't know you raised that. I don't see it as anything to do. I'm not.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, I know you don't, but that question.
I take all my arguments from biology. I don't take, yeah. Well, I don't want to be rude on your show, yeah, but about what I think about the folk, but
yeah. Okay. So
except I think the folk are often more right.
Yeah. Fair enough. So let me, you know, speaking of the folk, you mentioned this earlier, the whole idea of racial realism. Yeah. So that's a very, you know, hot topic these days. You mentioned Quaishon Spencer. So what is your view on that? I mean, how does your views of essentialism intersect with debates about racial realism?
Right. And realism. Also my views about realism, the chapter on race reflects certainly the sort of essentialist arguments that I have developed in the book before that, but also reflects positions on of scientific realism to do with natural kinds and so on. It does bring in the realism issue. Let me just pause and sum that up, because you asked a good question and I've gone around about it. Yeah. Partly what I say in the race realism and essentialism chapter is simply drawing on the ideas in the earlier chapters, and partly it is drawing on some other stuff to do with realism. And I wrote it partly because I got intrigued by the issue, but also partly because it was clear that what I was saying in the book elsewhere had implications, clear implications for the race debate. And that's why I took it on. The most important thing I think I'm trying to emphasize in my race handling of the race issue is you've got to distinguish the taxon issue from the category issue. What you get, one of the sort of provocative ways that the debate proceeds is people say race is real, or they say race isn't real. Race exists, race doesn't exist. All that sort of language, real and exist. But what does it amount to? I go through some various alternatives and I say, look, the only real issue that you can find here, you can split it down into two real issues. I mean, it seems, I could sort of run through that argument. Why is this the real issue? But let me just give you what I think the real issue. The real issue is a taxon issue and a category issue. And the real issue for the taxon is, are there biologically explanatory kinds of the sort that are thought to be races? And I say thought to be races because when you're doing the taxon issue, let's not worry whether they're rightly called races. We know what kinds are thought to be races. Let's look at them. Are they explanatorily interesting kinds? For example, people talk of Amerindians, the Indians, native indigenous people to the Americas, Amerindians, and people talk of Pacific Islanders, and they talk of Africans or Black Africans and so on. Are these explanatorily interesting And notice I'm not talking of races here. And are these explanatorily interesting? I'm not explicitly talking. It doesn't matter whether they're races. Are they explanatorily interesting kinds from a biological point of view? We're not talking sociological. We're just talking biology. And I want to argue that issue. I argue that issue. And I say, clearly, yes. I say there are subspecific, below the level of species, kinds in biology, leave aside humans from it, kinds in biology that are explanatorily significant and are often thought to be races. You know, there are four races of a particular moss. You'll see this in some dictionary I found. So there are subspecific groups which are explanatorily significant, I argue, and are thought by biologists to be races. And I think this is true also in with the human species. So that's the taxon issue. And I think the answer, as I said, is a resounding yes. Yes, there really are explanatorily interesting taxa thought to be races. And then there's the category issue, which is much more difficult. But do you want me to pause for you to respond or talk about?
No, we don't have a lot of time. So this is sort of my last,
I should move.
Last question then. Yes.
Okay. So the category issue is much trickier, and it's much less easy to give a definitive answer. That is the category issue. So the taxon issue was, are there biologically explanatory kinds that are thought to be races? Or if in the case of it, are there explanatory and certain human kinds that are human groups that are thought to be races? And I say resounding answer is yes. At the category level, are there explanatorily interesting categories? Is there an explanatory interesting category of race? Well, here, as I said, much more difficult. But what I mainly, one of the main things I do is look at, in general, at the issue of explanatorily interesting categories. So forget for a moment altogether about race and other subspecific categories, and look at the Linnaean hierarchy, species, genera, family, order, and so on. Are they explanatorily interesting? Well, you see, here there's a big debate has been a big debate in biology, and of course the consensus is no. people think species, we've got an explanatorily interesting category. Even there, this argument, that is, there are some people who argue very persuasively, in my view, like Hitcher and Yaroshevsky, argue that species, in effect, they're arguing, they don't put it this way, in effect, species is not an explanatorily interesting category. We need to break it down to use Yaroshevsky's terminology, eco-species, biospecies, and I've forgotten the other one, I'm sorry. That is, species itself is not an interesting category. We need sort of other sort of things at the specific level. So there's big argument even about species, but in general, people are realist about species. Yes, it is an explanatorily interesting category. Move up the hierarchy, and people say no. Yet they all keep talking about them. In fact, you can't open any article on anything just about without people talking about particular genera, family, order. Whole articles depend, it seemed to be, on taking category talk as scientifically serious. So you've got a real conundrum here. And I argue, and I argue in my race paper, and I've actually published a paper on this, that yes, the categories, notice I'm not talking about race here, the categories are explanatory, but perhaps only in a minimal way of indicating a hierarchy and explanation. My main thought as far as race is concerned, I apply this and I say, look, at worst, race is in the same boat we're talking now the category race. We're not talking about the taxa that are thought to be races. The category race, as far as explanatory biology is concerned, is in the same boat as the higher categories. And so that's at least puts some perspective on what the issue is. But I then apply the argument I gave a second ago, or gestured at a second ago, about the higher categories, namely that they are, in a minimal respect, explanatory in biology, at least in a minimal respect. I say that similarly, at least in a minimal respect, the category race is explanatorily helpful. The helpfulness of all of these categories in the minimal respect is indicating, okay, in only a pretty rough and ready way, indicating a place in the hierarchy. And that's significant, the hierarchy of taxa. The hierarchy of taxa is as real as could be. You're indicating a place in the hierarchy of taxa in a rough and ready way, which is helpful because it indicates a level of explanation. Just get back a few minutes ago when we were talking about Rufus, Fred, our red fox. You get different sorts of explanations at the level of Canidae, at the level of Rufus, and at the level of Rufus Rufus. And those levels are called family, genus, and species. They're different levels of explanation, as indeed I illustrated when I was talking about it. And that's the significance that you get from calling these a taxon, whatever, species, genus, and so on. You get an indication of a level of explanation. I think probably we need more than that, as I indicate in the book, but at least that's a start. And I think race is the same. Here we're going subspecific. Biologists make all sorts of distinctions at the subspecific level. Most famous, of course, is they talk of subspecies, but they talk of ecotypes, they talk of forms, they talk of demes and strains, and of course, they talk of races. So all of these are subspecific categories, rather poorly explained, and there's no uniformity about it. But what people are attempting there is to mark out levels of explanation.
Okay. So we're out of time, but I did want to ask one final question. Just what are you working on now? Have you gone into a different direction? Or are you still continuing along the biological essentialism track?
No, I haven't done any biology since I finished this book, and I sent it off, and I published the paper on categories, which I was just talking about. So I've gone back to the philosophy of language. Of course, I'm still very interested in, but I had some other things I had to get done. I'm putting together a volume of my papers on the philosophy of language, which is it's to be called Beyond Reference and Beyond. It's come out with Oxford. So that's what I have been working on in 2023. I haven't lost interest in this topic, however. I'm waiting for criticism. Of course, one of the things that happens when you publish a book is, you know, you've worked so hard on it for so long, and one sends it out into the world, and then there's this sort of deafening silence. So yeah. I'm hoping for a break in the silence.
Very good. Well, best wishes to you in with the reference book, and I look forward to seeing more of that. So, thanks again for talking with New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you, Carrie. Yes.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Michael Devitt, Distinguished Professor of Philosophy Emeritus at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His new book, Biological Essentialism, is just out from Cambridge University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.